Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ron's soulmate, Ken Reardon.
That's cellmate.
I'm sorry.
Cellmate,
I'm
not
sorry.
Soulmate.
I'm sorry, a typo in the script here.
All right, Ken, I know you are eager to talk about the Mark Sanford case, but I think we should talk about the other big news in politics this week.
Number 60.
Harry Reid receives his 60th cat. Thank you very much. I can herd them now.
I've heard of elephants, but I've never heard of cats. Minnesota, you're talking about Minnesota, correct?
I'm talking about this mystery man. Can we identify him from his voice?
People are finally beginning to think a little less about themselves and a little bit more about me, Al Franken.
And that, of course, was the beginning of the Al Franken decade on Saturday Night Live, a running bit that began in 1980.
And after 238 days, we begin the era of 60 Democratic senators. And Ron, that is big news. Everything changes, right?
No, I don't think everything changes. You have 60 Democrats. That's one more than 59. Actually, you don't even have 60
Democrats. You have 58 plus two.
You have 58 Democrats plus two independents minus two Democrats who haven't been to work in a while and are seriously ill.
Robert Byrd, who was released from the hospital this week after 6 weeks suffering from a staph infection, and Ted Kennedy, who is suffering from brain cancer, whose prognosis does not look great. We talk about 60 saying, well, the Democrats have reached the magic number. They'll get whatever they want. It still remains to be seen. Plus, you have the people like Ben Nelson from Nebraska, who often goes on his own course.
And has been recently saying how much he feels like going off on his own course, right, on health care and some other issues.
Joe Lieberman, who has voted his own way a lot of times on foreign policy. Evan Bayh, we saw him break from the Obama budget and perhaps other economic issues.
And that's not even to mention seven members of the Senate who are Democrats but come from southern states and have to bear in mind the fact that their states are, generally speaking, more conservative than their party.
Well, and Blanche Lincoln, right, who's up for re-election next year, and Arkansas went big for John McCain in 2008. So watch Blanche Lincoln. Watch Mary Landrieu.
Louisiana was one of John McCain's biggest success stories.
Who, even though she was just re-elected, she doesn't have election problems for another 5 years. She is also a less than reliable Democrat among those 60. So we can talk about 60. It's the first time since 1978, blah, blah, blah. It may not be that much, but a lot of people are taking the simplistic view that, wow, it's 60, therefore it's filibuster proof.
Right, so we never take the simplistic view on the podcast, but I do think you're right that not only on filibuster votes, but also on votes for certain budget processes, for example, the Byrd Rule, somewhat ironically named under the current circumstances, the Democrats could be short of the votes that they need to move certain kinds of budget considerations, including health care, if they choose to do health care as part of the budget reconciliation process. And that's as wonky as we are allowed to get here on the podcast, but it is another factor for the 60 votes.
And speaking of health care, we have Max Baucus, whose views on health care may not mirror that of the Rahm Emanuels and the Barack Obamas of the world, so there could be problems with that too.
There are all kinds of problems out there. This has actually been kind of a rocky couple of weeks.
It's a great time to be a Republican.
It's a great time. Well, there have been some reversals for the Obama administration. Yes, they got their energy bill through, but it was by the narrowest of margins,
and
they
had to 212, I think.
Yeah, very, very narrow margin, and they really only had one vote to spare over 218, and they had to do a lot of arm twisting to do it. They had to do a lot of compromising to do it.
They weakened the bill.
They have an ugly bill.
It is an ugly bill
at this point. And also, they've had some negative news with respect to the economy, sputtering in the recovery. We have a very bad jobs report.
1.9 million jobs lost in the first 5 months of the Obama administration.
And so you're going to have a lot of people out there saying that the stimulus isn't working, or at least it isn't working as it was intended to do.
Which Barack Obama conceded during his press conference a week or two ago, saying, well, it's probably not as good as we thought. It may be too soon to have a second stimulus, but they're aware of it. I think Vice President Biden also said that it may not have been the panacea that we thought it would be.
All right. So all of these things kind of conspiring at this moment to sap some of the energy and the rising trajectory of the Obama administration. But they do have at least this much good news. They did pick up one more Democratic seat in the Senate, as Al Franken was declared the winner in that disputed election by the Minnesota Supreme Court unanimously. So, whither Norm Coleman?
Well, there's been talk, of course, about him running for governor. Now, he ran for governor once before, 1998.
Lost to Jesse
Ventura. And, of course, you know, it's interesting. So, he's now lost to a wrestler and a comedian back-to-back. Well, not back-to-back, because he defeated Walter Mondale, who was the former vice president, former senator, and out of politics for a long time. This is following the death of Paul Wellstone, of course. But he barely beat Walter Mondale in between his losses to the wrestler and the comedian. Now he's talking about running for governor in 2010.
And he may be the Republican nominee in 2010.
Well, maybe.
If only because there aren't a lot of other people who are right now looking terribly strong as a statewide Republican
in Minnesota.
Jim Ranstad. You've got Rignad Kassin.
Wait. I spell my name danger.
And I understand that Norm Coleman also has a financial problem.
He does. Well, first of all, he had to spend a lot of money on the appeal. Of course, Al Franken has his money taken care of because he's been raising money as a prospective winner and now as the winner. And Norm Coleman really doesn't
He's broke.
He's broke.
He's broke. And I don't think that personally, financially, he's in that great shape either. And so he doesn't have a lot of personal resources he could throw into it, as some other candidates have done in Minnesota, many other candidates have done. So it's not clear that he's going to have the resources to run for governor, but if he chooses to, I would guess that sympathies in the state will turn around a little bit and he will benefit from having made a gracious concession after all this
238 days.
Right. But his numbers were dropping largely because people thought he should give up and get out. Mm. Now I think he'll get a little bit of recovery. And if Republican fortunes are rising in 2010, if it's a midterm election that not atypically is going against the president's party, Norm Coleman could win another time statewide in Minnesota.
That's true. I mean, Minnesota has gone longer than any state in the country without voting for a Republican for president, and yet it does manage to elect Republican governors.
Quite consistently. So, Al Franken comes to Washington. What kind of a senator do we think he will be?
Well, you know, you think of him as bombastic. You think of him saying so many impolitic things.
You think of him on the radio.
Well, you think
of him on Air America during
Air that America period. And Saturday Night Live and the books he's written, you know, Rush Limbaugh is a big fat idiot and all those things. But I thought during this whole protracted waiting for a winner, he was uncharacteristically civil and smart. I mean, he was low-key. He didn't say anything outrageous, outlandish.
I think they had him drugged.
And he also actually cited Hillary Clinton as somebody to perhaps emulate. The fact is that even though she was such a national figure when she was elected to the Senate in 2000.
And seen in very extreme terms.
Right. She also did her homework, went to work right away, and was a serious senator.
Won over a lot of her colleagues, even on the Republican side.
Yeah.
I've talked to people who seem to think that Al Franken's going to come back here, and rather than trying to be the wit of the Senate, that he will come back and try to impress people with his seriousness, and even with a certain amount of, dare I say it, bipartisanship.
Although I think there's some people like Rush Limbaugh, I saw a quote the other day that I think he's trying to bait Franken into saying something outlandish, and it'll be interesting to see whether Franken takes the bait or not.
He's going to have an opportunity to show us what direction he's going right away, because he's being installed on the Senate Judiciary Committee when he takes the oath of office in the first full week of July. And when he goes on the Judiciary Committee, the first piece of business before them, hearings for Sonia Sotomayor, Barack Obama's first choice for the Supreme Court. How are those hearings going to go, Ken?
There was a very interesting, I thought, a very silly and simplistic headline in the Washington Post this week that said, well, the Supreme Court overturning the Ricci versus DeStefano, the white firefighters in New Haven, the reverse discrimination case, that it may not derail her chances with the Supreme Court. It may not have nothing to do with it. And I don't think anybody, even the opponents of Sotomayor, and there are opponents, I thought the headline was silly because I suspect it has nothing to do with her chances for confirmation. I mean, there are a handful of Republicans. Look, if you have 60 Democratic senators, of course, you don't know if Byrd and Kennedy will show up, but let's say you have 58 votes for her, and then you have a handful, at least. You have the two women from Maine. You have Mel Martinez. You have a bunch of Republicans voting as well. You still may see a sizable, perhaps he's 30 Republicans voting against her, but that's it.
The theory by which this all comes up is that because she was one of the judges at the appellate level that upheld the New Haven decision that threw out the test results and thereby disadvantaged the white firefighters, because of that, it was going to damage her reputation in some terrible way and associate her with excesses of affirmative action, reverse discrimination, and that she would become, if you will, the poster child of reverse discrimination, and as such, she would be subject to some sort of withering and humiliating cross-questioning in her hearings. Do you expect to see that, Ken Rudin?
No, and that's what's so strange about it. The Supreme Court's ruling on Ricci was 5-4, so if Anthony Kennedy went the other way, then it would have been the majority, and then she would have been prescient.
And I'm glad you've been prescient for this entire podcast.
Yes,
now, because we have had so much substance. We've talked about legislative stuff and administrative stuff and economy stuff, and we've talked about the Supreme Court. So now it's time for dessert.
It's time for S-E-C-K-S. I can't even spell the word. I'm so embarrassed. But we have to talk about it because our listener demands it.
We're going to be very sober about discussing this. The governor of South Carolina is considering resigning over some stories.
Wait. I don't know if he's considering resigning. Everybody in the state says he should be considering
resigning. Well, he's been called by the senators of his own party. He's been called by the congressmen who are closest to him. He's been called by the man he favors to be his successor as governor. All of them saying, I think perhaps time has come, governor, to... Well, all right, we don't need to introduce this story. It's better known than the Michael Jackson story. Mark Sanford, on the brink of ending his political career, having given interviews to discuss the particulars of his marital infidelities and to say that he's going to try to fall back in love with his wife, that was the point at which I would have loaded the gun.
Well, first of all, why isn't there... Look, forget about the political smarts or lack of saying from Mark Sanford, but why isn't there anybody on his staff who keeps him from doing these interviews?
Well, apparently no one on his staff has the authority to say, Governor, you can't do that. Yeah. You can't go down to South America to spend 10 days. He was apparently planning to spend 10 days down there with his mistress. He had apparently spent time with her in New York City
at the
Republican National Convention in 2004. You and I were there.
There wasn't that romantic for us, was it? Except that one time. Two words, Ron Sbarro pizza.
So I think, Ken, what we're hearing here is an example of too much information. And I think that's really what the people down in South Carolina are saying. We might have forgiven you a lot. We might have forgiven you lying about where you were, being out of communication with your own staff, and the horrible way you're treating your family. But we can't forgive you telling us all about it again and again. Please go.
I think the first reaction I had was, I feel so sorry for Jenny Sanford, his wife, and no longer do I feel that way. I think I just feel so sorry for Mark Sanford and his inability to see what he's doing to everybody, including him.
I feel sorry for his state. This has not been a great period of time for South Carolina in general, because another son of South Carolina, John Edwards, who, of course, represented North Carolina
in
the Senate, but was born in South Carolina, talked about his South Carolina roots a lot.
My father worked in a mill all his life.
Is also still caught up in a unsavory story of marital infidelity, proving once again that the one part of American politics that is truly bipartisan is the sex scandals.
Andrew Young, not the civil rights leader, of course, but the former aide to John Edwards who took the fall for Riel Hunter's pregnancy last year.
He said the child was his.
It was his.
When it, of course, was not.
And then apparently, I mean, he was a true believer, John Edwards, and apparently he's changed his tune completely, saying, first of all, I did it to take the fall for John Edwards. Actually, John Edwards is the father. John Edwards denies it. When Elizabeth Edwards is asked, she says, I have no idea. But he's writing a tell-all book now. Apparently, Andrew Young found this sex tape of Riel Hunter and John Edwards, as the New York Daily News said, taking positions that were not in his official platform.
Okay, I think we have pretty much reached a new low here. So let me, if I can, attempt to take it a little lower. Even as we are fascinated with these sex stories, which do tend to drive stories about the economy off of page one.
And drives up our ratings.
We have been witnessing a remarkable spectacle within the Republican Party with regard to the fallout over the loss in November, specifically as it has to do with Sarah Palin.
They're still fighting that fight.
Why are they still fighting that fight? Why is this going on? We see Bill Kristol, the editor of the Weekly Standard, specifically trashing Steve Schmidt, who was the McCain-Palin campaign manager, and Schmidt firing back by name and naming all these people and saying horrible things about each other. Why does this not go away?
Well, I don't know. That's a good question. If you think of what happened after 1964, there was a lot of finger-pointing after Barry Goldwater's overwhelming defeat, but it didn't last for 6 months. They're still blaming Sarah Palin, or Sarah Palin's people are blaming John McCain, or they're blaming each other.
Is this about her continuing presidential ambition?
Well, that's the thing, too. Barry Goldwater is not going to run for president again after 64. Sarah Palin, on the other hand, is one of the Republicans' brightest lights.
Are you saying she's still running for 2012?
A lot of people can think she is.
And would you say she was still running based on the pictures of her in Runner's World?
I thought it was an unusual photo of Runner's World, not because of a seductive pose or what she was wearing, but the fact is that next to her, thrown on a chair, was the American flag.
Casually. Very casually.
I think it was treasonous, if you ask me.
Well, let's just say that everything she does in the media continues to generate a certain amount of controversy, both within her own party and within the media. So, as we are, of course, always rigorously nonpartisan, We should point out that a certain lack of internal party discipline is showing among Democrats in the state of New York.
Yes, and actually that's unusual for the Democrats because we've seen in the past a lot of intra-party...
You mean recently unusual with respect to Senate races, not unusual historically,
that's very
or
true.
In the state of New York.
Right, but I mean, certainly the Republicans don't have that discipline. We see what's going on in Florida. The establishment backed Charlie Crist for the Senate seat. Marco Rubio is backed by conservatives, and so there's going to be an ugly primary there.
Marco Rubio.
And despite the efforts by Vice President Biden, by Rahm Emanuel, Carolyn Maloney, the congresswoman from the Upper East Side of Manhattan, is deciding that because of the ideological impurities of Kirsten Gillibrand, who was appointed to the Senate,
Hillary Clinton's seat,
she will challenge Gillibrand in next September's Democratic primary.
2010.
And of course, this is not what the White House wants, because, and that's not what Chuck Schumer wants. They want a united party to keep that seat. But Maloney, I guess, feels impatient. Her time has come. And Gillibrand's views on guns and gays and immigration and things like that are not exactly in tune with the liberal wing of the Democratic
Party.
The Manhattan wing.
Right? Although they may be more in tune with the rest of the state. Quickly, who will be the Republican nominee for the Senate seat in New York next year, Ken?
Well, I don't know, because Peter King, the congressman from Long Island, has now cold feet. He's now saying that my work in Congress is very, very important, and he's now backing off from that. So it could be what we've seen for the Republicans in New York for the last couple of cycles, a non-entity running for the Senate or governor.
A rare case of cold feet on Long Island. And that's it for this week's political podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rubin.
Join us again next week for It's All Politics from NPR.